This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight.
First, we can say that uncertainty is growing by the hour. In fact, a short time ago, the main opposition leader, Raila Odinga, flanked by his lieutenant in the massacre mission, made it very clear that they don't see a possibility of an election on the 26th of October.
That's my colleague Vincent McCorry in Nairobi. We'll have the latest in Kenya politics, including a lawsuit being filed today, coming up. Also, at least four people have been killed across Togo in clashes between security forces and protesters demanding an end to the rule of President Fior Nyasimbe. And a jury in the U.S. city of Philadelphia convicts a Liberian warlord of lying about his past as a rebel commander in the Liberian Civil War. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the Daily Nation newspaper, reports President Uhuru Kenyatta's Jubilee Party has filed a contempt of court case against NASA leader Raila Odinga and his running mate Kalonzo Musyoka on their no elections call. The case was filed today at the Supreme Court in Nairobi. Also, Kenyatta refuses so far to meet with Kenya's Electoral Commission chairman, saying he needs to be on the campaign trail. My colleague Vincent McCorry is in Nairobi following developments and spoke with me about what this latest turn of events means for the country.
First, we can say that uncertainty is growing by the hour. In fact, a short time ago, the main opposition leader, Raila Odinga, flanked by his lieutenant in the massacre mission, made it very clear that they don't see a possibility of an election on the 26th of October. One of the reasons that looks like something that has some credence is that they have not heeded, and they don't seem to be willing to heed the call by the chairman of the Electoral Commission, Mr. Wafula Chebukati, to have a meeting between President Uhuru Kenyatta and Mr. Raila Odinga to solve or resolve some of the issues that could have called a fair, free, and credible election. Uhuru Kenyatta made it very clear that they have no interest in having a meeting, having a dialogue with Mr. Raila Odinga at the IBC. As far as they're concerned, the only dialogue they want to have is the voters during the voting day. So it looks like things remain uncertain because the chairman of the Electoral Commission has made it very clear that unless there is a meeting between the main opposition presidential candidates and the president of the country, Uhuru Kenyatta, and that certain officials of the IBC step aside, it doesn't look likely that a credible and free election can take place.
Would the elections take place at all then?
It remains to be seen because if you listen carefully to the Electoral Commission chairman, he kind of implies that unless those changes happen right now, he would not guarantee that an election would happen, and if it happens, that it would be credible. But he has also kind of hinted that he could step aside, could resign potentially if he feels like the environment does not kind of create conducive atmosphere for an election that can be credible, and he does not want to be the person who will preside over an election that will not be credible. But at the same time, he is warned that if these things are not resolved and that they do not come together and talk about what to do about the date of October 26, the country could potentially explode into chaos. So everybody is praying that something will happen between now and the 26th. Nobody is sure that this election will happen. But of course, the Jubilee Coalition is saying the election has to happen. The opposition on the other side says the election will not happen.
What are people on the ground saying? I know you said that they are praying and hoping that this is resolved, but what are some of the things that you're hearing?
Well, it all depends, again, on who you're talking to. Those who are supporters of the ruling coalition, Jubilee, believe that the election should go on and that their candidate, the President Uhuru Kenyatta, would win. And they believe he won in August. And so they don't really care about what anybody says. Those in the opposition coalition, NASA, believe that the election should not take place now that even their presidential candidate has officially withdrawn, but they believe that any election that will take place will be illegal. Any result that will come out of those elections will be the legitimate. At the same time, there are those who are in the middle ground who are saying perhaps it is time to suspend this process and consider having an election in 90 days, a fresh nomination, a fresh election, perhaps fixing the problems of the electoral body so that whatever election that will take place will be credible.
That was my colleague Vincent McCorry speaking with me from Nairobi. At least four people have been killed across Togo in clashes between security forces and protesters demanding an end to the rule of President Faure Gnassingbé. Opposition members today are in the second of 2 days of demonstrations against Gnassingbé, who came to power in 2005, succeeding his late father, President Gnassingbé Ayadema. Security Minister Colonel Damahame Yark said yesterday that one person was shot dead in the capital Lomé, while three others were killed in Togo's second largest city, Sokoto. Yark says 60 demonstrators were arrested in yesterday's clashes. Protests have broken out across Togo since August over Gnassingbé's proposal to amend the constitution by removing presidential term limits. Doing so could potentially allow him to stay in office until at least 2030. The elder Gnassingbé served as president of Togo from 1968 until his death. A jury in the U.S. city of Philadelphia has convicted Mohamed Jabate, known as Jungle Jabba, of lying about his past as a rebel commander in the Liberian Civil War in the 1990s. Yesterday, Jabate was convicted of immigration fraud and perjury for deceiving U.S. officials about his role in the war. Prosecutors brought 20 witnesses from Liberia who testified that Jabate or his soldiers killed civilians, raped women, and engaged in cannibalism. Jabate admits he fought in the war but denies taking part in atrocities. His lawyer argued prosecutors had been hoodwinked by the witnesses. Liberian journalist Tite Jabro has been in Philadelphia covering the three-week trial. She told VOA's James Butte that Liberian expatriates in the Philadelphia area are divided on the case. Many think that Jabate, who built a shipping business in the U.S., shouldn't be punished for what happened in a war more than 20 years ago. However, Jabro says others see the case as a warning for those who committed war crimes and are trying to evade punishment. Remittances from the overseas diaspora constitute a vital part of the economy of many developing nations, none more so than Somalia, where the inflows add up to more than foreign aid and investment combined. But analysts warn the industry is poorly understood by regulators and puts people at risk. There are hopes new technology will broaden the market and lower fees. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Every month, Fatma Ahmed sends $200 of the earnings she makes in London to her family in Somalia.
It's for daily life, for rent, for buying the grocery things and to live over there, because actually in Somalia that much we don't have.
The 2 million Somalis living overseas send an estimated $1.3 billion back home every year. With no formal banking system in Somalia, most of the diaspora use remittance services. Abdirashid Diwale is CEO of Dahab Shiel, one of Africa's biggest remittance services.
Now it's so instant, where we have the latest technology, which is the internet, secure channels that we can use to send money back home. Or we use mobiles and other means of, you know, smartphone and technology, where it will help us to deliver money quickly, but also less costly. Technology is supporting us also with a compliance issue.
Remittance companies still rely on global banks to route the money. Those banks must comply with regulations on money laundering and the financing of crime and terrorism. Citing those concerns, many have chosen to withdraw from the market, unnecessarily, says remittance industry expert Laura Hammond of London's School of Oriental and African Studies.
Very often it's not based on any kind of empirical evidence that shows that money is going into the wrong hands. The fear is just, you know, Somalia, there's a conflict in Somalia, there's the Al-Shabaab movement. And so there's a problem, in a sense, a real precarious nature of the Somali remittance industry.
The industry got a high-profile boost last month as the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation donated $1 million using the remittance firm Dahabshiil, along with mobile phone companies Somtel and eDahab, with the money transferred live to 1,000 families suffering the drought in Somalia. Former US President Barack Obama also attended. The technology is moving fast, but the cooperation of the global banking system remains key, and the remittance industry wants regulators to do more to support this lifeline. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Sixteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta files a lawsuit against opposition leader Raila Odinga. And at least four people have been killed across Togo in clashes between security forces and protesters demanding an end to the rule of President Faure Gnassingbé. For more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Islamic militants staged a two-pronged assault in El Arish on Monday in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. Militants threw grenades and traded gunfire with guards at an unused Coptic church to distract from a bank robbery across the street. Security experts say the timing and the location of the attack on a busy commercial street reflected the militants' confidence despite significant security forces in the area. David DeRoach is the senior military fellow at the Near East South Asia Center for Security Studies. He spoke to VOA's Mohammed Al-Shanawi about the rising wave of attacks in Sinai and what the Egyptian government could do to counter them.
It's symptomatic of the problem that the Egyptian government has basically with the lack of governance in Sinai. I mean, it's not absolutely certain these were Islamic militants. This could just be a criminal gang that's extremely well organized. But, you know, El Arish is the biggest city in the Sinai. It has a huge security presence. There was, by some accounts, a two-hour-long gun battle around the church and the bank. And the fact that the forces weren't able to react to that in an overwhelming manner shows that what you see are security forces who are primarily bogged down on static checkpoints, fixed positions with heavy weapons, and are not mobile among the populace, not really able to respond to anything or shift. So what you see is the classic government security overreaction that, and there will be an overreaction, I'm sure of that, but it's not able to provide what's really needed to deal with the insurgency in the Sinai, which is effective government services.
The latest attack came just a day after Islamic State group attacked military checkpoints in a nearby town, killing 9 soldiers. How do you explain the extremist ability to carry out spectacular assaults despite Egypt's all-out efforts to contain the long-running insurgency in Sinai?
Yeah, a lot of the Egyptian effort is actually counterproductive. So what the militants are doing is attacking fixed positions. The government responds by building bigger, more fixed positions. The militants are able to move among the population because they either through fear or sympathy or cooperation, they are able to move among the population. The Egyptian security forces are not, unless they're in large, overwhelming numbers. And this is the classic counterinsurgency dilemma, which is the Egyptian reaction is likely to be one or two large raids against a population center that they think the militants hid out in. That will probably destroy less discriminate manner than is needed and will probably make the population side even closer with the militants.
What should the Egyptian government do differently to counter the Sinai insurgency, short of relying mostly on security measures and emergency law?
Well, you know, the problem is this has been going on for so long, it's going to be very, very hard for Egypt to recover from it. But there's a couple things they have to do. The security effort has to go on, but it has to go on in a subtler and more focused manner. And it's very easy to say that everything's an intelligence problem. It's kind of a sophomoric approach to security, but what they need are smaller, mobile, more targeted raids that actually are against militants and militant hideouts, focusing particularly on weapons. Right now, what you see is an overwhelming response that's usually focused against population centers. The second thing is they have to go in and establish, in many instances in the Sinai for the first time, confidence in the Egyptian government. And that means things like services that are effective and well-run. So this would be water and medical, corruption-free distribution of basic commodities. They have to do that in a manner that, you know, makes people want to deal with them and that will allow them to gain some familiarity with the tribe so they can develop a knowledge of the insurgents.
That was David DeRoach, the senior military fellow at the Near East South Asia Center for Security Studies. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi. Well, Uganda's Ministry of Health confirmed today one person has died of Marburg hemorrhagic fever, a close relative of the Ebola virus. Surveillance teams have deployed to the affected district in the eastern part of the country to contain the outbreak. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Uganda's Ministry of Health says one of the two suspected cases of Marburg virus disease has been confirmed via laboratory tests conducted by the Uganda Virus Research Institute. Dr. Jen Ruth Acheng is the Minister for Health.
The confirmed case was a 50-year-old female from Chemuron Village, Kwen District in eastern Uganda. She presented with signs and symptoms suggestive of viral hemorrhagic fever. Preliminary field investigations indicated that prior to her death, the deceased had nursed her 42-year-old brother, who died on September 25, 2017, with similar signs and symptoms.
According to the World Health Organization, Marburg is transmitted via contact with bodily fluids of an infected person or the handling of infected animals. Local media report that the deceased woman's brother was a hunter. The Ministry of Health has dispatched a rapid response team to the Queen District.
As of this morning, because their surveillance obviously started from the hospitals where the confirmed case passed away, we have 10 health workers who have been listed as contacts, and they have already been isolated in their homes for follow-up.
Uganda is no stranger to viral hemorrhagic fever. The country has battled several outbreaks of Ebola, including an outbreak in 2000 that killed over 200 people. Marburg is named after the town in Germany where it was first identified in 1967, though that outbreak was traced back to infected monkeys brought from Uganda. Dr. Miriam Nanyunja is the Disease Prevention and Control Officer for the World Health Organization in Uganda.
We have the caves that have the bats that are capable of transferring infection to man in different parts of the country. You can never know when the next outbreak will be. It depends on when man interacts with an infected bat from one of these caves.
A person suffering from Marburg presents with sudden onset of high-level fever and headache. This can be accompanied by vomiting, joint and muscle pain, and unexplained bleeding. There is no cure or vaccine available for Marburg. Patients are given supportive treatment to increase their chance of survival. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Participants of a conference in Cairo have been pondering the use of new technology to build the future of African cities. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from the Egyptian capital.
A three-day gathering of African innovators and entrepreneurs got underway at Cairo's French University Wednesday as enthusiastic participants shared ideas and discussed technological developments to help build a better future for the continent's estimated 1.25 billion residents. Nigeria's Afrolabs organized the conference, and its head, Michael Oluwabgemi, believes that using technology is the key to breaking down artificial borders between people and countries.
We need to start using technology to break down the artificial walls that we've set up among ourselves. Technology offers a unique solution. Technology, after all, does not respect borders.
One topic centered on the need for African universities to do a better job of innovating and of using those innovations constructively. Participant Idris Bello complained that universities are often failing to tailor their intellectual assets to their productive output.
We have failed to closely link what we learn in schools with the issues, the problems we have in the ecosystem. And so you have thousands of projects just sitting in libraries, sitting in books, without being commercialized or translated into actual solutions to our problems.
Despite the best efforts of the African continent's nearly 250 universities, no African country was listed on last year's Global Innovation Index. Another subject that participants focused on was the active engagement of women in the economic and technological future of their countries. A woman entrepreneur, Florence Toffa from Ghana, deplored the cultural stigma in many African countries of women becoming active entrepreneurs.
For most of the women that I come across, the common challenge has always been right after school, the expectation from family is that maybe get a job, get married, and then start a family.
Afrolabs stressed its own theme of using technological hubs in several dozen countries on the continent to connect those seeking solutions in one place with problem solvers in another. As the head of one hub in West Africa put it, we need to encourage Africans to be job creators rather than job seekers. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, a look at Kenya's opposition protest and election confusion as the nation prepares for a repeat presidential vote. Citing irregularities, Kenya's Supreme Court nullified the results of the August 8th presidential poll. Understanding Kenya's presidential election on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.